You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz. Coming up, we learn more about the origins of the term cancel culture and how it fits in with our ideals of accountability and free speech. Now, state lawmakers voted to close the Lincoln Hill and Copper Lake Juvenile Detention Center 4 years ago. That came after years of allegations of abuse and violent interactions between guards and inmates. But despite that, both facilities remain open today. And according to new reporting from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, some judges, left with few other options, are being forced to continue to send young people there. We're talking about what's driving that delay to close Lincoln Hills and how that's impacting our local justice systems across the state. We'd love to hear from you. Do you want to see Lincoln Hills closed down once and for all? What changes do you want to see in how the state approaches juvenile justice? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us ideas@wpr.org. We have with us Sarah Volpenheim, Report for America reporter covering underserved communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Molly. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad you could join us. Well, Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, they were supposed to close almost 10 months ago. What's kept that from happening?
Yeah, they were supposed to close by law by July 1st of last year. And it's likely that they won't close for years to come. And that's because the replacement facilities that lawmakers envisioned would be built to replace Lincoln Hills have not been built. That's been because of a range of setbacks having to do with underfunding, disputes over where to actually put the facilities, and other setbacks. Recently, though, within the last couple of months, state lawmakers did finally pass a bill to fund the construction of a new state-run juvenile correctional facility in Milwaukee County. The governor is expected to sign that in the next couple of weeks, and that should at least get this process going in a more positive direction and put in motion the actual closure that's been really delayed and stalled for the last several years.
Yeah. But so in the meantime, we still have judges that need to do something. They're looking for facilities to send youth that are in the system that need some kind of rehabilitation. What are the options?
Yeah, it's true. Judges don't have a lot of options for the kids who have the most needs, the ones who have committed, you know, more serious offenses.
Hey, Ken, it sounds like we're having some technical issues.
Really,
for some reason,
they try, a
link where you
they
can
feel like they
to
have
the
to as a last resort.
A little bit of a delay,
if nothing else is working.
Sarah's portion of the interview too.
They
so stand by for
kids that.
That
they decide need a secure or a locked setting. Are Lincoln Hills or Mendota Juvenile Treatment Center, which is in Madison, or at least in Milwaukee County, there's also a county-run program that's seen as an alternative to Lincoln Hills. The first half of it takes place in detention, but then the kids transition back into the community for the second half. And that is kind of like the step down from Lincoln Hills. It's like the next most serious placement that a judge might choose for one of the more high needs kids that they're seeing. But the problem is sending kids to Lincoln Hills is kind of a legal gray zone. Been some uncertainty about whether it's even legal to send certain kids there. But at the end of the day, you know, judges have relied on this workaround to still try to send some kids there.
Right. So there was this plan to develop these regional centers that would provide alternatives to this one, you know, these two centralized state facilities. And as you mentioned, they have not come to pass yet. So is there enough capacity on the local level for programs to help young people?
Yeah, that's one of the things that we found in our reporting was that the local options are very overwhelmed right now. They're under a lot of pressure. That county-run program that I mentioned for more serious offenders or kids with the highest needs, the one that's the step down from Lincoln Hills, that one has a waiting list. Kids can be on this waiting list for months. In my reporting, found a 16-year-old kid who has been on the waiting list for 2 months. He's just sitting in detention waiting for a spot to open up in this program. And while he's on this wait list, he's not getting the services that he would get as a part of that program. And he's not able to avail himself of those tools to, get treatment and get back on the right track.
So in the meantime, where are these kids? These kids are being held in local jails?
Some of them are basically what's happening is judges are relying more heavily on this county run program, which is called MCAP, the Milwaukee County Accountability Program. So they're putting them, they're telling them to wait in the county detention center until a spot opens up in that program. But they're also still sending some kids to Lincoln Hills. They're not allowed under the law to close Lincoln Hills, to send kids directly to Lincoln Hills at disposition, which is the juvenile equivalent of a sentencing. But judges have kind of relied on this workaround, which is in this kind of legal gray zone where they sentence a kid. Prosecutors file what's called a change in placement, which asks the judge to reconsider their sentence and to commit the kid to Lincoln Hills. And then normally the judge will hold another hearing, hear the arguments, and then make a decision on that request. So kids are still getting sent to Lincoln Hills, even though technically it was supposed to have closed last year.
And do we know how many kids are there currently?
For Milwaukee County, it's somewhere between 30 and 40 young people that are there currently that the county is responsible for paying for. There's also additional Milwaukee County youth there who are there on what are called serious juvenile offender cases, which the state is responsible for paying for them. I'm not totally sure how many there are of that, but it's safe to say there's dozens of youth from Milwaukee County at Lincoln Hills right now.
So what's currently on the table as far as solutions for this situation?
Yeah, really what I hear from judges and from attorneys is that we need more local options. And, part of what they're calling for is the county-run and state-run juvenile facilities that have not been built, even though they were supposed to have been by this point. As we've talked about, the state-run facility is we're seeing some progress on building the state-run juvenile facility in the county, but there's also attorneys and the judges calling for county-run facilities or for more local programming, especially advocates who are very involved with youth justice issues want to see more local programming that addresses the needs of kids outside of a correctional setting in more of, a less restrictive setting. So there's calls for that as well.
Well, we will continue to follow your reporting and the reporting of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on this issue. Thank you so much for being with us today, Sarah.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sarah Volpenheim is the Report for America reporter covering underserved communities for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Up next, we'll hear from someone who's studied juvenile justice for decades about where the movement to close Lincoln Hill started and what it would take to make that a reality. Would love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. What would a better juvenile justice system look like? We'll continue this conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're looking at the ongoing efforts to close Lincoln Hills. We'd love to hear from you, maybe your own experiences with the state's juvenile justice system. We'd love to hear your thoughts. 1-800-642-1234. You can always email us, ideas@wpr.org. Ken Streit joins us now. He's a retired clinical professor of law at UW-Madison who studied criminal justice and juvenile justice for decades. Ken, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So you've studied criminal justice for such a long time. From your perspective, why has closing this facility been so hard to do?
Well, let me just go back. So, I mean, I hate to be too old, but about 40 years ago,
I didn't mean it that way.
But about 40 years ago, in the early 80s, the state changed its way of running state juvenile institutions. And so instead of providing quote unquote free placements for the kids, they took the $30 million that they were spending on the two institutions and gave that to the counties. And then said to the counties, if you can find something, a better way to handle it, use this money. If you need to send them to the to the state institutions, we're going to charge you. And the cost back then was about $2,000 a month, about $25,000 a year. At that point, immediately, some counties who were probably not really needing to send their kids at all before immediately stopped and used their resources to build their programs. And over 40 years, those have sort of continued to develop so that by the early 2000s, they were at the point that they didn't really have enough kids to justify two institutions. So back in the early 80s, there were like 1,200 kids. By the early 2000s, there were about 600 kids. But what happens is it becomes more costly every year, or as the number of kids in the institutions go down, the per diems go up. So right now it's about $400,000 per kid. There's about 50 kids at Lincoln Hills right now.
And how much did you say? Ken, how much did you say?
$400,000.
$400,000?
$400,000 a year. Yeah. So, but what happened was all that time, it was basically county-led deinstitutionalization, county-led community programs. Increasingly, counties such as Racine is a good example, realized that having the kid in the community and then having the local public school be the school teachers for the kids there and having the parents around turned out to be not only cheaper, but turned out to be far more effective as far as reintegrating the kids into the program. So that's how, increasingly counties develop the capacity to take care of a lot of the kids. And I'm just going to be a little generalizing. So the first 90% of the kids were relatively easy to program back into the community. Right now, we're at about 5% of what the level was 40 years ago. And those are really challenging kids. So an example is Milwaukee, for example, has 40 kids in a unit that's basically a six-month program. There's a lot of kids who can do 6 months in a rehabilitation, high education, high achieving kind of program. Now, they can do that maybe standing on their heads when they're in the program. No guarantees that that's necessarily going to be effective later on, but they can very well comply with those kind of expectations. Then there are kids that just don't do that well in those programs. Mm-hmm. And so then the challenge, and my guess would be a lot of the kids who are at Lincoln Hills are kids who have a whole variety of reasons why they can't be in the program. in addition to the 40, 50 kids there at Lincoln Hills, there's also about 30 kids at Mendota Mental Health Center. And those are kids with even more serious mental health challenges. A lot of them are kids who respond inversely to typical kind of discipline. So when they're disciplined for bad behavior, they just follow up with more bad behavior and all that. Mm-hmm. So the kids at Lincoln Hills are sort of in between that group. And what happened was that 4 years ago when they decided to close the facility, I think they just didn't understand that you needed to have some clearer direction of who was going to be responsible for developing the programs for that last 5% of the kids. Again, you know, it always had been developed by local leadership. And the difference was that, like in Racine County, they were already had budgeted. They knew that they needed a new program. So the funding that was available for Racine was, I don't want to say it was a gift to Racine, but they knew they were going in that direction anywhere. And so the amount of money that the state gave out 4 years ago was plenty for Racine County. On the other hand, Milwaukee was sort of flat-footed. They had not really done that. And so I think there was a lot of sort of walking side by side with the county looking at the state saying, are you going to take the lead? And the state saying, boy, we're really bad at citing correctional facilities in counties. Would you take the lead?
Right.
And so nobody really clearly had the responsibility. And the legislation sort of provided opportunities, but it didn't provide expectations. And so when both of them, the county sort of passed, because when they looked at what they would have to build and what it was going to cost them, the amount of money that was available in the original legislation just wasn't nearly enough. And then I think probably right now I heard the reporter saying, I mean, I think the state is wanting to do this one program with what's currently a minimum security facility, which means for adult men, which is a pre-release, guys who have been in prison for a long time so they can get jobs and things like that.
I see that we have a caller on the line, and I want to invite her into the conversation to join us and hear what you think about her comments. So we've got Allison on the line in Stevens Point.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me on.
Hi, yes, what's your thought or question for Ken?
Yeah, I really appreciate this conversation, and I think we need to be having more of these. So often, though, they have such limiting parameters where we're not able to think, you know, a step beyond, you know, what's good for these kids. And ultimately, they're kids, and we forget about that. We call them inmates. And really, like, we can all agree that what the ideal juvenile justice system looks like is one that basically doesn't exist. Like we can all agree that we don't want to punish kids. That's not something that we strive to do. And so, you know, when we talk about shifting money from this pot to that pot, we ultimately, like, are so stuck within the parameters of what's been done before that, you know, we forget things that are just tried and true facts, like prevention dollars go 10 times farther than treatment/punishment dollars, like the fact that basic childhood development understandings tell us that kids in cages away from the people who love and care about them the most, even if those people, you know, are in situations that are pretty dysfunctional, ultimately is not a way to heal a child or anybody else.
Got it. Allison, got it. I want to hear Ken's response. We've got just a few moments left. Ken.
Okay.
Alternative.
So I think I think the difficulty with, let's just, like I said before, the 40-day program that Milwaukee and Racine and a variety of other counties are doing, it meets the needs of a wide range of kids. It's not inexpensive. And each of those kids, those are cookie cutter kids. They sort of are able to bring together enough staffing. You need sort of a critical mass of population before you can afford to have enough of the different variety of specialists that you need to respond to kids. that last 5% really then becomes a much, their needs are even more wide ranging. I would disagree. I would never call the kids inmates. I would never call these prisons. They are insecure kind of facilities, but the approach is very much a treatment and rehabilitation approach. One of the things that they found out with Lincoln Hills is that they were sort of staffed at an 11-to-1 ratio. They realized that they really needed to be staffed at about a 6-to-1 ratio in order to have the positive effects that they were needing to have. Now, that's a very intense ratio compared to a lot of other programs, but they at least realize that. So that I think they are really investing and trying to make the kids healthier. It's not putting them in cages, although it's incidental that it's a secure facility. And I think because those needs are so intense and so wide ranging, you really do need to gather a lot of people and be very intentional about the facility that you're going to need to have, because it doesn't look like a facility that you've thought about before for kids who are high school age kids.
Well, Ken, we've got just a few seconds left. What's the thing you're watching for next with this?
Well, I think what they really need to do, what the legislators have to do, is, if they haven't been told this before, to recognize that historically this has been a grassroots kind of thing which had no state mandate. I think between the legislature and the governor, they have to point a single leader to develop the programs.
Someone
to make this happen.
Has to take
Otherwise,
responsibility.
It's not going to happen.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Gotcha, Ken. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you for inviting me.
We've been talking to Ken Street, retired clinical professor of law at UW-Madison, talking about the effort to close the Lincoln Hills Copper Lake Juvenile Detention Centers. Coming up on the morning show, Lee Rayburn talks with three neighborhood leaders in Milwaukee about what they're doing to strengthen their community. The program works block by block to improve the quality of life for residents. You can learn all about it tomorrow morning after 7 on the morning show. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. So you've probably heard the term cancel culture, where someone does or says something and is publicly criticized or shamed. Sometimes they lose their job or a contract or a book deal. Sometimes they just get mocked. The New York Times editorial board wrote an op-ed last week claiming that America has a free speech problem. It said, and I'm quoting, "Americans are losing hold of a fundamental right as citizens of a free country, the right to speak their minds and voice their opinions in public without fear of being shamed or shunned." But has this right ever existed? How do you feel about free speech in the U.S. today? Do you feel free to speak your mind? We want to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Joining us to discuss is Meredith Clark, Associate Professor in the School of Journalism and the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University. She's also the founding director of the College of Arts, Media, and Design's Center for Communication, Media Innovation, and Social Change at Northeastern. Meredith, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I'm glad you can join us. And I wonder, do you think America has a free speech problem?
No, I don't think that America has a free speech problem. I think that we have a few problems, and those include a gross misunderstanding of the First Amendment, as well as an inability to keep up with the impact of communication technologies that make it much easier for many people to be heard all at the same time.
When you say an inability to keep up with, what do you mean by that?
So what I mean is that when we talk about cancel culture and we talk about people who are facing criticism or outrage in some cases based on things that they have said or done or failed to say or do, we are beginning to grapple with what it means for so many people to have access to a means of technology that allows us all to speak at the same time and to be heard in the same places. So 15, 20 years ago, I'd even go as far to say 30 years ago, if a public figure like a celebrity or a politician made a stupid comment or made a harmful comment, then one of the few ways that people could express their discontent with what the person had said or done was by writing a letter to the editor, or perhaps in the early eras of the internet, posting a comment on a message board. Now we have social networking sites that allow us to immediately post our initial reactions and our initial thoughts, as we've seen a few times this week as we react to a number of current events that stand out to us. And frankly, we are just not equipped right now to be able to deal with the fallout when so many people are able to speak and be heard at the same time.
So do you think social media is an inherently more democratic form of media?
No, I don't. Social media, we tend to, in the United States, I think we tend to take for granted internet access. There are so many areas across the country that do not have ready access to broadband internet. And so there are people in those areas who aren't able to be able to speak and be heard in the same way. And then, of course, we can look at how people use social media to different ends. And we can understand very quickly that those people who are enabled by structural power to be heard anyway have an outsized voice and an outsized presence on these social networking platforms. Celebrities who speak out about different issues are going to be heard and going to be received in ways that everyday people are not. And vice versa, those people who speak out and become basically the star of the day on social networking sites, they may have their 15 minutes of fame, but they don't have the same sort of infrastructure and machinery around them to control what sort of feedback they get based on what they've said or done.
Right. And we still have such a shallow understanding of what it means to go viral, how that actually happens and what's involved.
Absolutely. Going viral can be everything from, you know, doing something that's pretty novel on the internet or fairly cute and winning endorsement deals to becoming a main character on Twitter. This is something that someone tweeted a few years ago, that on Twitter every day there's a main character and the goal is basically not to be it. You could be that main character on social media in one day. And if you've been a private citizen all your life and now all of a sudden you're out in front of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people because of something you've said or done, you may not have the resources in place that will allow you to do reputation management or even to protect your family if people decide that your comments are worthy of what they feel like is appropriate, which may be everything from applause to death threats. So we've got a dramatic imbalance there.
And we have people lining up to talk with you, Meredith, and I want to go to the phones next. And I'm going to go to Kate in Madison. Good afternoon, Kate. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my phone call. This is such an important topic. I will say my comment, and then I'll listen to your response off air, if that's okay. I do not feel that America has a freedom of speech problem. I feel Americans have an entitlement problem. And I say that because I feel as we grow as a culture and we recognize that it is not okay to say some things out loud that are hurtful, spiteful, hateful, there is a sect of society who wants us to be able to do those things without repercussion. And we're used to doing those things. But as we've grown in our humanity, hopefully, we recognize, no, we need to call out people for bad behavior. I will say that brings up the other point I would like to say. I think a lot of Americans forget that the freedom of speech does not mean freedom from repercussion. Right. And I think a lot of people forget that point, and that that needs to be people need to be reminded of that. So thank you for your time. Thank you for bringing up this topic. It's very important.
Thanks, Kate. Well, there's a lot there, Meredith.
Well, I think Kate nails it, though, and she says the two key things there, that we have a sense of entitlement, we have an entitlement problem, and then she underscores the fact that we have a gross misunderstanding of the First Amendment. The First Amendment and the five freedoms enumerated in the First Amendment include a right to speech, to assembly, to press, to petition the government for a redress of grievances, and for the government not to interfere with the practice of religion or the abstaining from thereof, right?
Right.
And so when we talk about a freedom of speech, what we are talking about is the ability to be able to speak without the government interfering in the speech that you have. And even then, there are some limits to that. And Kate mentioned hateful speech or harmful speech. And there are protections in place to keep people from engaging in speech that incites violence, that targets one particular group for a certain reason, whether that's because of their origin or their background, their identity, what have you. We know that there are a number of limits there. And so this is completely different from the way cancel culture is being described as an infringement on free speech. These are two completely different arguments, and media really fails us when they talk about them as though they are the same thing.
Right. And when you have an editorial from one of the largest newspapers in the country.
Yes, I have to say that as I call myself a retiring journalist, I worked in newspapers for about 10 years before I entered the academy. I was profoundly disappointed at the New York Times editorial board's choice to author this editorial that claims that Americans are losing our right to speak without shame or being shunned. That right is not enumerated anywhere in the Constitution nor in the Bill of Rights. It is not mentioned in any of the legal precedent that we have on the books that helps us to understand how we think about the practical application of a freedom of speech. There was an earlier editorial that I wrote a piece that reacted to in 2020, where a number of creatives talked about the fact that what we have is in our public deliberations on these platforms, those old spaces, the institutions that we're used to, everything from newspapers to universities to businesses, we have yet to catch up with how we want to manage the consequences of speech from social media spaces. And that is the problem that we really need to focus on. This isn't a matter of there being a problem that there are too many speakers or even that there are people who are engaging in harmful messages. We need to focus on the fact that there's legislation being passed to limit speech, and also that there are overreactions to incendiary speech in some cases, or to harmful speech in other cases. And we really, really need to do the hard work of figuring out what appropriate reactions to those instances are.
We're speaking with Meredith Clark, Associate Professor in the School of Journalism and the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University. We'd love to hear what you think. We're at 1-800-642-1234. How should we hold people accountable for their words and their actions, online or otherwise? 1-800-642-1234. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz. We continue our talk with Northeastern University Professor Meredith Clark about concepts of cancel culture, free speech, and accountability. We had a caller, Lisa in Madison, who asks, Meredith, can you address how the wave of misinformation and disinformation complicates our notion of free speech? How should we decide who gets to be the arbiter of what's acceptable when so much is outright fake?
That is an excellent question. So I think it's no accident that we are grappling with this question of what cancel culture is and what it means for open discourse and deliberation in our society at the same time that we are having to deal with waves of mis and disinformation. And we're thinking about each of these things. And just to provide a brief definition, first, I take issue with the framing of cancel culture. The inclusion of the term culture, it serves to separate this into a behavior that is done by a group of people who are undesirable. And it's often assigned to people who don't have the opportunity to speak or to be heard. And then with misinformation and disinformation, we know that misinformation is basically information that is incorrect, but not delivered with a malicious intent, whereas in disinformation actually seeks to deceive people and to mislead them. And so what I am seeing and what I'm most concerned about is that cancel culture is being used to attempt to delegitimize very timely, incisive, and necessary points of conversation and argument, and ultimately to dismiss those arguments and those points that are being raised as either misinformation or disinformation. And when you obscure the points that people are making, and those points are well-reasoned, those points are grounded in history and in facts that are searchable, that can be discovered and that can be verified through a number of different ways, and then you label those as that's cancel culture or that's misinformation or that's disinformation, basically you are engaging as an agent of chaos. And so that's really something that I think that we all need to think about, that every time someone trots out an allegation of something being cancel culture, what facts in the argument can we actually verify we can find more information about in order to discern whether this is a legitimate argument, whether it's misinformation or whether it's disinformation.
We had another caller who said, Terry in Green Bay called in and said, we have freedom of speech, but not freedom of reach, I think on the point of social media. And let's see, we've got a caller now coming in from Valley Junction. We've got Jimmy on the line. Jimmy, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I got a question. I know that she explained about the First Amendment being attributable to government actions against a person. But what if an employer, just a private sector employer, fires you for your political persuasion, whatever that might be? Is there any recourse to that? It'd be kind of like the private sector doing the government's dirty work to get around the First Amendment. And I'll take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Jimmy.
Well, I have to first qualify this by saying I'm not a First Amendment lawyer, nor am I a media law scholar. But what I can say is that employers can make demands about how employees conduct themselves, because that feeds into the employer's reputation. And so as a matter of reputation management, what we see in many cases where people claim their free speech rights are being infringed upon is actually a corporation engaging in its own best practices to make sure that it is not harmed or found liable for an employee's speech. Again, being a journalist before I became a professor, one of the things that we were taught very early on, of course, and that has to do with the idea of objectivity in journalism, but not expressing our political opinions openly. And that had not only to do with getting the public to see us as neutral, but also with making sure that we were protecting our employers from allegations of bias. And we see that replicated with companies that do attempt to ask their employees to adhere to codes of conduct, including the way that they speak and express themselves politically, so that it does not reflect badly upon the company.
Right. And it depends on the employer. And I've got another call for you. Meredith Pat is on the line from Green Bay. Pat, what's on your mind? Hi.
Okay, well, I guess this is a two-part question. First part is, correct me if I'm wrong, but there are consequences when inaccuracies are put into print, in the printed media, correct?
Consequences? Yes. You mean legally?
Like libel or
correct
something on that.
Slander, sure. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you. Okay, So does that not tie into social media? If somebody is slandered, do they not have a recourse?
Yeah, Pat, good question. Meredith.
So there is recourse for individuals who are the victims of libel or slander. Not to dig too deep into the media law aspects of it, but there's a burden of proof that is necessary for the person who feels they have been wronged, whether that's libel or slander, whether that is written or spoken is often how we think about that. That burden of proof has to do with malicious intent. It has to do with whether someone had knowledge of what they were writing, printing, or saying being true or not. It has to do with the scope of how far that claim went and what sort of actual harms the person who was the target of that speech actually received. One of the reasons that we experience, I think, such tension with how people are able to use social media to malign one another is that social media networks are not regulated in the same way that speech in other places is. So we hear a lot about some of the laws that govern social networking platforms. We consider them platforms and not publishers. In the United States, publishers we think of are newspapers, are broadcast stations. Social networking sites are considered platforms. They are places where business takes place, where people, and that business is communication, it is connection, and it is not regulated in the same way. And that is what we hear so much about when we talk about legislation being revisited to reclassify social networking sites as publishers and in some way responsible for the things that people say and post there.
Right. And that's such a key distinction. So I wonder what you think about what regulation there should be, if any, on social media platforms.
I do think that there should be some regulation. We are in an era where technology, the law has not caught up with technology. And this is pretty true of every era of technology that we have. So we're thinking about how companies like Facebook, now known as Meta, do we consider them monopolies? And I think that it's important for us to take very seriously the responsibility that our government has to act on behalf of the people and to look at doing some regulation in terms of exactly what reach these platforms have and what is allowable in terms of speech on their specific channels. One of the places that I also think about this and how important it is in other regions of the world where Facebook is the internet, where people are reliant upon this one particular platform that is not well regulated in its home country, and they're reliant on that for information. And there are few controls that are in place to keep people from spreading misinformation there and from weaponizing that platform for ill use.
So while they may be considered a platform, they are functioning as a primary media source for many people.
Correct. Correct.
So thank you so much for joining us today, Meredith. I feel like I could talk to you all day, but I'm up against the clock. Thank you so much.
I understand. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking with Meredith Clark, an associate professor in the School of Journalism and the Department of Communication Studies at Northeastern University. She's also the founding director of Northeastern's College of Art, Media, and Design Center for Communication, Media Innovation, and Social Change. You're listening to Central Time, and I'm Molly Stentz.